Hello, and thanks for listening to the Ordinary Philosophy Podcast. Here, you can listen to interviews and audio renditions of pieces published at Ordinary Philosophy's website, dedicated to philosophy in the public square and the history of ideas that change the world. For more about Ordinary Philosophy, to see the photos which accompany this account, and to discover the sources and inspiration for each piece, please visit ordinaryphilosophy.com. Ordinary Philosophy's website and podcast are independent and ad-free, and depend on support from patrons and listeners like you. To find out more about how you can contribute to Ordinary Philosophy, please visit the Subscribe, Submit, and Support page and donate today. And if you enjoy what you read and hear at Ordinary Philosophy, please share with those you believe will enjoy it too, and take a moment to rate and review this podcast on iTunes. I'm Amy Cools, creator and editor of Ordinary Philosophy. Episode 59, Frederick Douglass, Rochester, New York Sites, Day 2. 10th day, Tuesday, March 29th. I begin my day with an early visit to Dr. David Anderson, a Frederick Douglass scholar, visiting professor at Nazareth College, founding member of Black Storytelling League, and an all-around delightful and fascinating man. He is kind enough to grant me an interview of an hour or so, which actually turns into a much longer conversation than that. Among many other things too numerous to describe in full here, I'll bring more details of our talk into the discussion of my subsequent discoveries, we talk about the Douglass family as a whole, and especially Frederick Douglass's wife, Anna. As discussed in my earlier account of my day in Lynn, Anna took in piecework from Lynn's thriving shoe industry, attaching uppers to soles, to help support the family. According to Anderson, she brought in enough money doing this to put all of the money which Douglass sent home from his 1845 through 1847 British Isles tour into the bank. This is but one example of Anna's hard work and skill as a household manager. The extent of Anna's contributions to Frederick's life is often overlooked, Anderson says. If people understood the degree to which Frederick relied on Anna, emotionally as well as logistically, people would understand much more about him too. From the beginning of their relationship, Anna supported his efforts to better himself and to make his escape, selling some of her belongings to fund it and helping him to plan it all out. Anna made the Douglass family home a happy one, and for many stretches, especially in Douglass's earlier years as a traveling speaker, she was often the sole financial support of the family. And when Frederick was away on his innumerable meetings and lecture tours, she sent clean clothes ahead to wherever he was traveling, so he was always ready to appear in public neat, tidy, and comfortable. Anna did all of this, though she could not read or write. As Anderson points out, people often confuse illiteracy for lack of intelligence, and this simple fact, in addition to the general reticence of her personality, has long caused many to write her off as an influential or even very significant figure in Frederick's life. In fact, she was resourceful, orderly, dignified, creative, and kept their ever-changing and complex life as a family of a traveling speaker and activist together, all while taking care of their constant flow of house guests, including Underground Railroad refugees. As she had been in Lynn, Anna was initially a member of the local anti-slavery society, but withdrew at some point. Anderson says it was because of apparent disdain of some of the members for Anna, perhaps because of her lack of education. I ask Anderson if the society was elitist, but he thinks, while this is a possibility on the part of some members, he doesn't see J.P. Morris, a successful barber and leader of the black contingent of the Rochester Society, this way at all. Presumably, Morris would have set the tone for society meetings. Whatever or whoever the source of Anna's discomfiture, she was a dignified person, and it's easy to see why she would withdraw if she did feel her dignity under attack in any way. For more about Anna Douglass, please listen to my conversation with Lee Fott, who has made a study of Anna for her upcoming book on the women in Frederick Douglass's life. Among the many things I discuss with Anderson, I ask him where Rochester City Hall was in 1865. When I had looked for it, I found that the first official one, now called Irving Place or Old City Hall, was built in 1875 at 30 West Broad Street. He thinks it was probably on Broad Street because that was the city center, but to make sure I have the exact location, he directs me to the Central Library of Rochester and Monroe County, to the city historian's office in the Rundell Building at 115 South Avenue. So that's where I head next. The Rundell Building is a handsome structure built spanning the years from the 19-teens through the 1930s, and its pale gray-brown stone walls are punctuated with inscriptions, including this paraphrase of a John Dewey quote, "Education is more than preparation for life, it is life itself." I'm sure Frederick Douglass would hardly concur, as much as he stressed the practical importance of education as well. Librarian Sherry Christ, so knowledgeable and so generous with her time, proceeds to help me find what I'm looking for. Not long ago, she made a far more exciting discovery, a previously unknown Frederick Douglass photograph, taken in about 1873 and lost in the depths of the archives for over 100 years. Today, Christ provides me with sources to help me track down the 1865 location of City Hall, starting with a search of the index card files, though we don't find any that indicate the right time period there. We decide to cross-reference some index entries with old newspapers, and Veronica Shaw helps me find old microfiches of the Rochester Daily Union. Our initial hunt leads us, after many twists and turns among newspaper accounts and old atlases, to an early location of City Hall. I'm all excited about the discovery until a careful rereading of the evidence shows that this was in fact old City Hall, prior to 1856, too early for the historical event I'm following today. Though we first find the wrong place after much searching and end up having to start over again, I find the wild goose chase to be lots of fun. It involves searching through pages and pages of old newspaper facsimiles and city atlases, getting a good glimpse of the history and layout of the city that I wouldn't have gotten otherwise. I've been thoroughly enjoying the level of historical detective work this Douglass journey has led me into all along. We do subsequently find old City Hall, which, funnily enough, turns out to be a much simpler search. It's just that the right clue doesn't turn up first. We had started with the index card files rather than the old city atlases. More on that soon when I get to the site. In any case, I hope this search leads to a new index card in the city historian's files for City Hall between 1856 and 1875. I realize, as soon as we find the site I seek, that the day is really getting on, since I spent such a long, absorbing time with Anderson at Nazareth College and Christ at the city historian's office. I skedaddle to my next destination, the same place I start my tour of Rochester yesterday. It's the Susan B. Anthony House at 17 Madison Street. I visit the Susan B. Anthony House today for many reasons. I know Douglas and Anthony were friends, at least sometimes, and of different degrees and kinds when they were. Henry Louis Gates' timeline of Douglass's life in his autobiography's Compendium and History mentions Douglass visiting her at her Rochester home more than once in 1850, and other sources describe their visits as a regular occurrence around that time. And since they were sometimes friends and always activists in the same causes and lived in the same city for so long, Douglass must have visited Anthony here, right? Well, I find out early in the tour that while Douglass may have visited Anthony at this house, and there are many good reasons to think he had, there's no actual documentation of this. Anthony moved into this house 15 years after that particular 1850 documented visit, and other visits on several occasions while she was living in the family farmhouse now on the outskirts of Rochester near the airport. More on that in his future account. Douglass lived in Rochester until 1872, and Anthony was among his many friends who pleaded with him to stay. So they must have been on good terms at that time, and she had been living in this house for 7 years at that point. I consider it likely, given all this, he would have visited her here at some point. I have a most delightful visit, in a quiet moment between tours, with Linda Lopata, the visitor center manager, and Carolyn, Mary, and another kind woman whose name I can't recall at the moment. If you read this, please excuse my forgetfulness, and I would be delighted to be reintroduced. They have a wealth of information to share and couldn't be more kind, and are so sweet in their interest in my project and willingness to help. We talk some about Douglas, about whom they're quite knowledgeable, and a lot about Anthony, including her arrest at this house for voting in the 1872 presidential election, along with 14 other women. Try as I might, in an hour-plus long search, I can't find their names listed anywhere. It bothers me somehow to leave them anonymous, as all the sources I've found so far do, when they acted as bravely and with as much conviction at the polls as Anthony did. I would be grateful, dear reader, if you happen to know and can pass the word along where to find them. Unless, of course, these women desired their names to remain anonymous, as was their right, to avoid scandal or censure. The officials who allowed them to register to vote likely sympathized with their cause, and were certainly convinced by her interpretation of the 14th and 15th Amendments, that the first strongly, and the latter less so, implied that women had the right to vote. Douglas, the ardent feminist and advocate of universal suffrage, must certainly have approved of this bold move, and the fact that all save one voted for his preferred candidate, Ulysses S. Grant, would have pleased him too. But he was no longer in town to lend his support in person, since he and his family had already moved to Washington, D.C. that July. My next destination is less than a mile, almost directly east, at South Fitzhugh Street, just a little south of Maine, to the site of the City Hall in 1865 we had searched for so assiduously this morning. The digitized 1863 map we found on the Monroe County Library System's website shows that it stood where the Monroe County Executive Offices now stand at 39 West Main. The long red brick building's north end covers the site. As you can see from the reference or legend at the top right of the map that is linked on the website, number 55 identifies that City Hall location just across the street from the old City Hall site we discovered at the corner of Main and tiny Pindle Alley, and just a little north from the Irving Place Old City Hall built in 1875. All three are within a 2-block radius. I seek this site today because Douglas gave an impassioned, impromptu eulogy here in remembrance of his hero and friend, Abraham Lincoln. A crowd had gathered here on April 15, 1865, to mourn Lincoln's death that morning, and they called upon Douglas to speak. He did so, delivering, by all accounts, one of the most moving addresses he ever gave. As Douglas sadly told them, "It was only a few weeks ago that I shook his brave, honest hand and looked into his gentle eye and heard his kindly voice." That occasion was on March 4th of that same year, when Douglas went to the White House to congratulate Lincoln on his second inauguration and the excellence of his address. As you may remember, Douglas was critical of Lincoln's first inaugural address with its weak stance on slavery. The second, besides its sheer eloquence and beauty, was unapologetically anti-slavery, so of course Douglas hardly approved of it. Douglas went to the White House on his own account and was turned away at the door by two officers who said they were instructed by Lincoln not to admit black people. Douglas accused them of lying, which they were, and insisted on entering. He was ultimately successful, and when Lincoln spotted Douglas across the room, he called out, "Here comes my friend Douglas," and shook his hand. This was a moment of great triumph and validation for the proud and dignified Douglas, and he would treasure it for the rest of his life. My next destination is just two long blocks north, at the Downtown Presbyterian Church at 121 Fitzhugh Street. It's a lovely building with beautiful stained glass windows. It takes me many, many attempts to snap any photos I can use since the sun is sinking low right behind the church. And still, I can't quite color correct the photos enough to do it justice. In the process, three ladies on separate occasions stop to exclaim something to the effect of, "Isn't it beautiful?" and invite me to an event going on there that evening. On an adjoining building to the left of the church, there's a plaque commemorating the 1848 Rochester continuation of the Seneca Falls Women's Rights Convention, which we'll discuss in my next day's account of this journey. This used to be the Unitarian Church, and the meeting was held in the church building itself. Douglas spoke at this convention as well, according to Ms. Lapata at the Susan B. Anthony House. In his remarks, he reiterated his conviction that he could not deny a woman any right he claimed for himself, nor could any just individual do so. Next, I zigzag my way a little over half mile east to the historic Cornhill District, where the Memorial African Methodist Episcopal Zion Church now stands at Favor and Clarissa Streets, just off Ford. According to Cindy Boyer, Rochester's Landmark Society Director of Public Programs, Clarissa Street was once the business and cultural heart of Rochester's African American community. In the 1950s, it became a jazz and entertainment hub. Exploring Clarissa Street on my way from the current location of the AME Zion Church at 549 Clarissa Street to the old site, I notice one of those distinctive blue historical marker signs and discover that the great bluesman Son House lived on Clarissa at Grieg Street in the 1960s. Cool. The original site of the AME Church was just a little east of this one, on the northeast corner where Spring and Favor Streets once intersected, near where the 490 freeway now passes through. Anderson directs me here in our discussion this morning, as the Douglas family belonged to this progressive congregation, dedicated to reform and the education of black children. The church was also an important stop on the Underground Railroad. It had been reorganized and rebuilt by Thomas James, a former slave who became a minister and educator who founded new congregations in several cities. James was the one, according to Anderson, who had licensed Douglas, many years ago, to preach in New Bedford. According to Michelle Finn, deputy historian of the city of Rochester, the third church building, which is depicted in this photograph, featured memorial windows dedicated to Douglas, Anthony, Harriet Tubman, and others. I wonder why she wrote featured in the past tense. The photos reveal it's the same building that stands today, and it appears there are stained glass windows within the outer panes I can see from where I'm standing. Perhaps the stained glass windows are no longer intact. The church is all closed up, padlocked, and surrounded by a chain link fence, so I can't approach it to make sure. I continue on, crossing over the Frederick Douglass Susan B. Anthony Memorial Bridge, which carries Interstate 490 over the Genesee River in downtown Rochester, to my next destination. At 271 Hamilton Street, at Bond, there's a two-story blue house which was not long ago discovered to be a home owned by Douglas and his daughter's family. This makes it the first house that Douglas owned and stayed in for any length of time that's still standing, so I'm very excited to discover it too. Anderson's colleague and fellow historian, Jean Zirkus, made the discovery of the deed for the house that had Douglas's name on it. "She's serious," said Anderson. Zirkus has made many other important discoveries in local history over the years, including sites associated with the life and work of Austin Stewart, one of Douglas's fellow black abolitionists and Underground Railroad operatives, and a successful Rochester business owner. Anderson also said, "Zirkus helped me in another way. She found out Austin Stewart had children buried in Rochester." Stuart is a fascinating figure. I'm very glad to learn about him and encourage you to do so as well. Like Douglas, he wrote a narrative of his life first as a slave, then as a free man, and an anti-slavery activist. Douglas's daughter Rosetta and her husband Nathan Sprague lived in this house for several years before following her father to Washington, D.C. Douglas kept the house, however, listing himself as a boarder. Since he had fought so long for the right to vote and residents of Washington, D.C. could not vote in presidential elections at the time, he retained that precious right for himself by keeping an official residence in Rochester. I head south next on Alexander Street and turn left on South Avenue, which continues to take me south toward Highland Park. I look for the historical marker, which I read is located at the site now occupied by James P. Duffy School at 999 South Avenue near Highland Park, and for the community library now named after Douglas. Anderson says he and other local historians and citizens are making good headway in getting the school renamed after Douglas, too. I easily find the school, which is being rebuilt. But I find no historical marker, though I circle the building slowly and scan the area carefully. Perhaps it's been taken down until the construction is done, or it's obscured by the large quantity of construction equipment and materials here now. In 1852, Frederick Douglass moved his family here from that urban red brick house on Alexander Street to a hilltop farmhouse on what was then the outskirts of the city. It was private, with no near neighbors, plenty of land surrounding it, and fruit trees galore, a perfect setting for five growing children and for sheltering runaway slaves. Both Douglass family homes in Rochester were Underground Railroad institutions. Douglas loved his South Avenue home and farm. He built a cozy office and library upstairs. He loved to ride his large white horse on the grounds. He planted trees with his own hands. His sons worked the land, and Anna kept a beautiful and orderly home. They lived here for 20 years, until June 2, 1872, when it burned to the ground. The family escaped unharmed, and friends helped the family save many of their personal goods and all of the animals, but many of Douglas's important papers and his bound volumes of every issue of the North Star were burned. We suffer their loss, too, as copies of very many have never been found elsewhere. Douglas was out of town the day the house burned and returned the next day, having heard the news. He believed the fire was purposely set. The fire insurance company agreed with him. He had continued to struggle with elements of racism even in this relatively tolerant city, the city he said he felt most at home in, enough to believe the worst. He was so bitter over it that he decided to move his family to Washington, D.C. for good. Their daughter Annie had died here in 1860 at only 10 years old. Perhaps Anna's unabated grief made her more amenable to moving from the place they had called home for 25 years. Then I continue up the hill, just a short stroll continuing south on South Avenue to Robinson Drive, to end my day's explorations at beautiful Highland Park. It was designed in 1890 by another Frederick Law Olmsted, designer of Manhattan Central Park and Brooklyn's Prospect Park. Olmsted is famous for creating some of the world's most beautiful parks, with landscapes designed to look as natural as possible while maximizing their utility as public spaces. I cross Robinson Drive to my right at an angle, then into the park down to Highland Bowl, the natural amphitheater between Robinson Drive and Reservoir Avenue, with an Art Deco-look open-air theater built at its west end. Across the large grassy depression that makes the bowl, halfway up the hill on the other side from Robinson and to the left, or east, of the theater, there stands an 8-foot statue of Frederick Douglass on a tall columnar pedestal with 4 plaques curved around it, 3 containing Douglass quotes. First erected in front of Rochester's New York Central train station in 1899, It was moved to Highland Park in 1941 to place it in a more beautiful, dignified natural setting instead of the dust and bustle of the street corner it had been on. It was also fitting to place it near the site of his beloved South Avenue home. As you can see if you look at the photos, though I've brightened them quite a bit so you can see the details, it's growing late. Dusk is drawing near. It's been a long and fascinating day. I learned so much it will take some time to process it all, and I'm tired. The park is soft and lovely this evening. The trees bare and gray and lacy with their delicate veiny branches. The grass beetle green in the lowering light. I gaze at the statue a while and reflect. Then I sit in the grass and rest, lazily typing up a few notes. I like the way the statue's hands are outstretched, palms up, as if Douglas is inviting you to draw near and hear what he has to say. So I'll let him close this day's account with his own words, etched on the side of the statue, until we meet again in the story of the next day of my Douglas journey. The best defense of free American institutions is the hearts of the American people themselves. One with God is a majority. I know of no rights of race superior to the rights of humanity. Men do not live by bread alone, so with nations. They are not saved by art, but by honesty, not by the gilded splendors of wealth, but by the hidden treasure of manly virtue, not by the multitudinous gratification of the flesh, but by the celestial guidance of the spirit. I know of no soil better adapted to the growth of reform than American soil. I know of no country where the conditions for effecting great change in the settled order of things, for the development of right ideas of liberty and humanity, are more favorable than here in this United States. To be continued. And as always, thank you for listening.